We think, I don't want anyone to know what I'm going through. Or, if others really knew me, they'd look at me with disdain and leave. In our isolation, the battle rages on. Yet deep inside, we are made for victory. We are lovers. We are fighters. We long for freedom. We want to be rescued. There's a much larger story that keeps us moving forward and crawling on our bellies through pain. Taylor Swift's music video, Out of the Woods, visually captures my battle as I fought for Connor's heart. I never fought as hard for any one human soul. While my marriage became a casualty, my life has been anything but that. Through these caverns of deep loss, something inside me burst open. With a fierce battle cry, I've discovered myself and the Almighty God and have rose to declare war. Every woman's story of betrayal has become a part of a much larger story. As women, we fight for redemption. We fight for truth. We fight for ourselves and those we love. Why? It's hidden in our identity. God could have called us anything, but instead, he honored us with a name that richly reflects his character, Ezer Kenegdo. The Hebrew word Ezer comes from two root words, one meaning to rescue or to save, and the other meaning to be strong or fierce strength. Crazy, right? In fact, the word Ezer is used 21 times in the Old Testament. Two times to address Eve in Genesis chapter 2 verses 18 and 20. Three times of allies being called into life-threatening situations. Isaiah chapter 30 verse 5, Ezekiel 12 chapter 14, Daniel chapter 11 verse 34. 16 times to portray God. Exodus chapter 18 verse 4. Deuteronomy, chapter 33, verse 7, 26 and 29, and several passages in the Psalms. In all these passages, Ezer is used in the context of a battle. The second Hebrew word, kenegdo, appears only once in the Bible when talking about women. Genesis, chapter 2, verse 18b. I love how R. David Friedman thoughtfully did his homework. He recognizes the debates among translators that haven't done the word justice. He clearly shows how the early rabbinic Hebrew language interprets the root kenegdo as equal in divine value. The word reflects our identity and great worth as women, just because of who we are. Putting these ideas together, it only makes sense that God created us, his daughters, to be Ezer warriors, women who fight for what's right and those we love. It's in our hardware. We're strong. It's who we are and how we were made. We know it's true. I watch women fight with fierce devotion for each other, their families, and for truth. We are life givers. While we can't do our husband's recovery work for them, as it's their personal battle and choice to make, we do have the ability to ask for truth, establish safety in our camps through boundaries, and call others up. Do you see yourself as an Ezer warrior? Can you think about a situation in your life that caused you to stand up for something that was wrong? Where you advocated for someone you love or rose up to defend or shield threats in your own camp? When we defend what we love, it's not out of obligation. Instinctively, as with a mother bear and her cubs, it's innate in us. From our first breath to our last, we are made to rise up. God sighting, we are not alone. It was a warm Saturday evening in Dallas, 6:51 p.m. to be exact, just moments before a powerful experiential healing exercise at a conference. Susan, one of the women on my prayer team, emailed me. Sherry, I've been praying without ceasing and feel like the Holy Spirit suggested something that might refresh you and the others at the event. You are probably already so familiar with Julie True, who does beautiful, ethereal healing music. Anyway, if you have an iPad, perhaps you could look up Julie True on YouTube and go to her song, Heaven's Embrace, Waves of Love You Delight in Me. I was imagining all the women at your conference being so loved by our Savior. Blessings and refreshing, Susan. While Susan was praying for us and listening to Heaven's Embrace, God showed up to prove his love for us. We had started a powerful exercise in which the women were invited to challenge one of their trauma-induced shame beliefs and replace it with truth. Just then, God painted a double rainbow above the Hyatt Regency Hotel. I was inside the conference room when it happened, but one of the women texted me the picture. She and her husband had just finished coffee outside when they saw the rainbow over the building. I loved the fact that her husband snapped the photo and was the one peering into the frame. God doesn't waste any opportunities and wanted her husband to see that he was fighting for both of them. Remember El Yoshuati, the God of my salvation, and El Roy, the God who sees me? God is alive, well, and on the move. I love to tell that story, and it's a testimony of God's hope and his saving strength. When you succeed, we will celebrate and shout for joy. Flags will fly when victory is yours. Yes, God will answer your prayers, and we will praise him. Psalm 20, verse 5. When we, as Ezer warriors, are confronted with this battle, God longs for us to put our trust in him and rely on his strength. We are not alone. When we courageously engage in our own healing, we become better equipped to stand up and fight for ourselves, our families, and truth. Chapter 14. Remember when sex was safe and skydiving was dangerous? I've jumped out of a perfectly good airplane twice and lived. Two things went through my mind as my toes curled over the edge of an open aircraft 14,000 feet above the ground. How did I get here? And why am I doing this? It was mind over matter. If I had thought too long about the tiny parcels of farmland below, I would have chickened out. My only solace was being strapped in tandem to a skydive master who said, "Don't overthink it, Sherry. Count with me. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, jump!" And I did. I bought the t-shirt, got the video, and I'm here to tell the story. But this can't compare to the out-of-control fear we experience while strapped into the hidden and unsafe sex life with a sex addict. In my case, I didn't sign up for it, nor did I want the story. Even though I lived, I sexually hit the ground on impact. The most difficult part of recovering from intimate sexual deception is what to do with sex. There is so little written on the subject and so much more that needs to be said. How do you repair a relationship after a sexual breach of trust? Since sexual acting out and lying go hand in hand, these wounds destroy not only our ability to trust, but also our capacity to be sexually vulnerable. Whatever happens to us sexually touches the deepest part of our souls. True confessions. Danny was devastated after his wife Alina walked in and found him having cyber sex with another woman. He later realized this fleeting moment of false pleasure created an immeasurable divide between he and his wife. I broke Alina's heart. There are so many days I wonder why she even stays with me. I'd been lying to her for months. It killed me to lose her respect. It's my job to help her trust me again. I'm working to stay sober, because I don't ever want to see that look on her face again. Yeah, I'm terrified I might fail. I'm going to SA and just finished my fourth step. Brutal, but good. My sponsor keeps telling me to work the program one day at a time. For months, I couldn't look at her in the eyes. Now I can. Getting out from under my shame has helped me love Alina in a way I didn't know existed. I think it's what real relationship is supposed to feel like. As with Alina, our sensuality, femininity, and body image have been deeply impacted. How are we supposed to heal when we feel sexually violated? So let's start with what's true. What does healthy sexuality look like? Counterfeit or the real deal? Sexual norms are continuing to change in our culture. Like sexual menus aimed at having it your way, the internet, social media, smartphones, and virtual sex at the click of a finger have created fast fixes. Today's porn is steeped in violations of sex, human dignity, and power. Porn is changing the way people treat people. It's changing the nation's sexual appetite and what it means to be human. We're not erroneous objects to be disrespected, shamed, or used. We are human beings intricately designed for respectful bonding that is sacred, sensual, and intentional. Because many of us grew up in homes where conversations about sex were non-existent, listen to the differences between healthy sexuality and unhealthy sexuality. So imagine a graph that says healthy sexuality on the left and unhealthy sexuality on the right. In healthy sexuality, sex requires safety and trust, versus sex is unsafe or involves a breach of trust. In healthy sexuality, sex is connecting and responsible, versus sex is disconnected and irresponsible. In healthy sexuality, sex requires honesty and transparency, versus sex involves deception, confusion, and mistrust. In healthy sexuality, sex can be playful, powerful, and vulnerable, versus sex feels shameful or helpless. In healthy sexuality, sex requires partnership and mutual consent, versus sex is coercive and involves non-consensual acts. Anything goes. In healthy sexuality, sex involves shared pleasure and gratification, versus sex is numbing pain through self-indulgence. In healthy sexuality, sex promotes dignity and affirms who we are, versus sex is degrading and involves being used. In healthy sexuality, sex is a natural drive which allows both parties to relax and enjoy, versus sex is compulsive and duty-driven. In healthy sexuality, sex is a caring experience that holds another's self-respect in mind, versus sex is a consumable, objectifying people to get what we want. In healthy sexuality, sex includes healthy communication that explores the five senses, what we say and how we touch. Versus, sex lacks healthy connection. There is no foreplay and the goal is to use the other for self-gratification. As a new bride, I was looking forward to celebrating sex with Connor. I didn't understand what was keeping him distant from me. It caused me to ask, what about me can't sexually please him? I just need to relax. Seriously? It's no surprise how women's and men's brains differ when it comes to sex. A team of scientists in the Netherlands used a PET scan to study what happens to a woman's brain during sexual arousal and climax. Researchers discovered evidence that fear and anxiety interfere with a woman's ability to receive the full range of pleasure that healthy sex offers. What this means is it's difficult to have an orgasm at the same times our brains are thinking about how we've been sexually violated. So there's a monumental chasm in helping the betrayer and the betrayed sexually risk again. It's no surprise the cornerstone of a healthy sex life is a loving, trustworthy relationship. The way we were. What was your view of sexuality before discovering your husband's hidden sex acts? Remembering the way we were gives us a starting point to heal. Tragically, some of us have lived through prior sexual violations. Others have not. Either way, it helps us to remember who we were before impact. Among the 100 women I surveyed, 95% said, "I felt safe with my partner until I discovered his or her sexual behaviors." Even though we know what safety feels like, we've been placed in a position in which our relationship isn't trustworthy. Just like any other tragic life experience, the discovery of our spouse's sexual betrayal changes us. 100% of the women surveyed said, "I feel violated due to my partner's sexual behaviors." 92% of the women surveyed said, "Since discovering my partner's behaviors, when I see sexually suggestive images, I feel anxious." 99% of the women surveyed said, "I have strong memories that remind me of my partner's participation in sexually inappropriate behaviors." And 22% of the women surveyed said, "I've been pressured to perform sexually in ways that were uncomfortable for me, like forced sexual pain, being watched while having sex with others, anal sex, sexual domination, or being filmed." Our thoughts are tormented by unwanted sexual static when we'd rather think about things that matter to us. Those of us with early abuse or chronic sexual deception often hear, "I told you so," in our heads. Something inside us shifted. Angela discovered her husband's porn included large-breasted women. "I hate my body. I used to think my size B cups were plenty. Sure, we've had 3 kids and my body doesn't look like it used to. I can't compete with a double D. I've called the plastic surgeon because I don't want him looking elsewhere, and I can't stand looking at myself." Of the women I surveyed, 79% of them grew up with some type of early abuse or trauma. This keeps many women from owning their no. We need to stop and take notice when someone is threatening us or professionals are warning us about sex acts that are harming our bodies. Early sexual abuse and trauma. What do we do when our history includes childhood sexual abuse and violations, such as sexual assault or unsolicited sexual exposure? Abuse occurs when someone uses sex to dominate, manipulate, humiliate, or sexually misuse another person against his or her will. William and Linda have been married for years and are currently separated. For the past 26 years, they've used porn to keep things interesting. When Linda turned 50, she started seeing a therapist and began noticing how dirty, unloved, and devalued she felt by the porn. When Linda was 4 years old, her grandfather offered to help her single-parent mother by giving her baths. He would pour a bubble bath, close the bathroom door, and while playing with toys, would regularly fondle her genitals. Even though Linda remembers feeling uncomfortable, she still wanted to be loved by her papa. He began having vaginal sex with Linda when she was 12. She grew up bewildered and felt sexually objectified for as long as she can remember. Linda was beginning to defend her sexual dignity. For decades, her marriage had focused on sexual intensity rather than intimacy by sharing their bed with thousands of women in sex scenes. How could William and Linda cherish each other with so many pornographic distractions in the room? Charlie Brown Syndrome. As part of Linda's healing, she asked William to make love to her without playing porn on the big screen TV in their bedroom. William refused and said, What's wrong with you? This is what we've always done. What William and Linda didn't realize is they were reenacting what Patrick Carnes calls a trauma bond. In his book, Betrayal Bonds, Carnes points to four elements that make up these toxic exchanges. Intensity, complexity, inconsistency, and the promise. It was that elusive promise of love coupled with her idealized hope that somehow William would magically change that made things so difficult for Linda. Each time they'd have sex, Linda would say, "No, no porn this time." And William would turn on the big screen TV. Linda felt even more shamefully degraded and stuck. Just like in the Peanuts comic strip when Lucy promises to hold the football for Charlie Brown, but time and time again yanks the football away as Charlie Brown kicks, landing him flat on his back. Trauma survivors can be vulnerable to manipulations or may put up with too much for too long, looking for a promise not based in reality. This is called defensive hope. In short, it keeps people from the pain they need to face. As with Charlie Brown, it's the expectation that something good will happen if we wish for it long enough. These relationship patterns are so deep that we can be looking right at the problem and not see it. For several months, Linda pleaded, hoping William would hear her and change his mind. It didn't happen. Linda had learned how to cope with her fear of losing the relationships by pleasing William sexually, pulling away, then returning with anxious reconciliations. "We've been together for 30 years and are exhausted by this roller coaster ride of fun times, fights, and erotic makeup sex." Linda was trying to negotiate consensual lovemaking without porn. William wasn't willing to address his porn addiction or honor her request. Linda wasn't aware how her untreated sexual abuse with her grandfather was impacting her boundaries, self-image, and view of sex. Linda was asking William to do something her grandfather never did: stop sexually objectifying her and treat her with dignity. Her separation from William became a powerful step and healthy boundary to clearly state what she wanted: a healthy attachment, relational safety, and sexual intimacy. Taking a look at how layered trauma or sexual abuse may be impacting you is a critical step in your sexual healing. It's important to tease out what's going on and help make connections between three things. 1, your past layers of trauma and sexual abuse. 2, your present sexual trauma and infidelity with your spouse. 3, your views of sexuality before and after betrayal. Healing requires we do the work to identify how we're reacting to the sexual betrayal, then take the steps to restore safety and heal our sexual wounds. 3 common reactions to sexual shame. Why is it that we get sludged by sexual betrayal? It's how shame works. Someone else's shameful choices stick to us like glue and produce a gut reaction in us. Of the women I surveyed, 93% said, "When my partner tries to get close to me or we are sexually intimate, I can't help but question whether my partner is thinking about me or things they've done." As a result, our minds wander. While engaging sexually, we wonder, "Is he with me or thinking about another woman's body?" When our minds are fearfully aroused, it's difficult for us to be sexual. Looking at common reactions to sexual shame helps us talk about where we are now. Several researchers have written about how shame causes us to use self-protective and disconnecting strategies to avoid the pain of shame and survive. They found that some people move toward others, some move away from others, and some move against others. I often explain these three shame movements by using a golden retriever, a turtle, and a hedgehog. Golden Retriever. Shame moves us toward others by pleasing and appeasing at any cost, attempting to earn connection. Turtle. Shame moves us away from others by pulling away, shutting down, hiding, keeping secrets, or not speaking up. Hedgehog. Shame moves us against others by fearfully trying to regain control or power through offending behaviors. Humiliation, resentment, rage, retaliation, or harm. This made so much sense in light of my own story and the stories of others. Since our self-identity is deeply connected with our sexual identity, I found these three reactions commonly happen with betrayal trauma: hypersexual, hyposexual, and sexual reactivity. Are any of these shame reactions currently happening with you? 1. Hypersexual, move toward. We attempt to repair the sexual shame we feel by trying to please. Our shame beliefs are often soaked in guilt and fear. It's my fault. I should have done something. I'm not sexy enough to keep his attention. I need to do what he wants to get him to stay. We fear being alone or losing the one we love. We go to great lengths to either win him back or keep him from acting out again. Hank wanted to have sex anytime, anywhere. I loved Hank and wanted a life together. When we got pregnant, he paid for an abortion. I was heartsick and got depressed after things sank in. When I couldn't perform sexually like I used to, he called off the engagement and left. Helen. I was shocked after finding images on Wesley's computer of men, women, and transsexuals. I did what any woman would do to keep her marriage intact. I went online and ordered $250 in sex toys, leather, and lingerie. I pimped up like a porn star for 2 months until I imploded. I ended up in the ER with panic attacks. I just couldn't keep up the pace or the charade. Janelle. Both Helen and Janelle were unknowingly fueled by their shame beliefs and desire to be loved. Hyposexual, move away. We try to avoid the pain of sexual shame by shutting down. We self-protect by pulling away. I'm in danger and don't know if I'm sexually safe. I'm not in control and wondering if this will ever stop. I can't ask for what I want or need. When things didn't change in my marriage, I began to feel more helpless and out of control. My body took its cues from Ugg and Amy and began to shut down. I didn't know how to ask for what I needed, say no, or set healthy sexual boundaries. I stopped caring about my personal hygiene, and depression became my body's way of putting up walls as if to say, enough is enough. Like a scared turtle, I retreated inside my shell. I still feel embarrassed when I remember Connor gently asking, Sherry, how long has it been since you last showered? Days ran together, and strangely, I wasn't even aware of it. Not showering became an unconscious way of trying to manage my safety. When we aren't being seen in our relationship, it can feel like surviving in the Sahara Desert. We can also become vulnerable to living out sexual fantasies and affairs. I remember calling my best friend Julie from a phone booth after a married man spoke kindly to me and gently touched me on the arm. I was hungry for love and surviving on fumes. Julie helped me stay accountable in my own sexual integrity. Without accountability, we can complicate our situation by having an affair of our own. Sexually reactive, move against. We move against the person who's hurt us by using shame, aggression, or retaliation to numb our pain. I'm rejectable, not wanted. I can get what I need by doing it my way. I'm not sexual enough. I'll find someone who wants me. I knew something was going on with Michael and his personal assistant. He told me I was just being jealous. So, I reached out to an old boyfriend on Instagram and told him what happened. He felt horrible and asked if I wanted to meet for drinks. Before I knew it, we were at his place having sex. For a brief moment, I felt deliciously wanted and desired. If Michael knew how much someone wanted me, maybe he wouldn't sleep around. Mackenzie isn't alone. She was trying to numb her gut-wrenching pain by moving against Michael. But fighting deception with deception never works. While random hookups and affairs appear to offer relief, they only cause more shame, confusion, and harm. If this is something you're struggling with, please ask for help. Meet with a counselor. Get into a support group. Ask your girlfriends for hugs. Reach out to a friend to be accountable. Manage your pain to help keep yourself from regret. Sexual trauma-induced shame beliefs. Working from a trauma model, it's easy to see how the impact of sexual infidelity changes the way we respond sexually and see ourselves. Most forms of objectified sex portray a woman as a collection of body parts rather than as a whole person. Karen heartbreakingly shared, "I am a horrible lover. He told me so." As we discussed in earlier chapters, these trauma-induced shame beliefs stick to us like glue. How do you see yourself sexually? Here's how 7 fearless women use the 180-degree turnaround to identify their negative sexual beliefs. They wrote their shame beliefs down and then turned them around for a more honest view of themselves. So imagine a graph that says restoring sexual truth. On the left-hand side are the trauma-induced shame beliefs about our worthiness, femininity, and sensuality. On the right-hand side are the truths about our worthiness, femininity, and sensuality. Alexis believed, "I'm sloppy seconds." Now she believes, "I am enough. I can ask for exclusivity." Lynette believed, "I'm damaged goods." Now she believes, "I'm okay as I am. I see how sexual infidelity marred my perspective." Kenesha believed, "I'm not sexy enough." Now she believes, "I can be sexually healthy. My sensuality is mine to hold." Karen believed, "I'm a horrible lover. He told me so." Now she believes, "I can love well. I have no desire to listen to blame or to compete with porn." Blair believed, "My body isn't perfect. I'm told I need to tone my abs, butt, and arms." Now she believes, "I am enough. My body doesn't have to be perfect to be loved." Melissa believed, "I'm overweight and out of shape. I'll never please a man." Now she believes, "I'm responsible for how I take care of my body and personal health." Rose believed, "I'm too old. I hate my body and can never measure up to what my husband has seen." Now she believes, "I'm desirable and seasoned and loving well. I can share my body and sexuality when it's safe to do so." By applying the 180-degree turnaround, you can take your first step towards identifying shame beliefs that are working to get squatting rights in your mind. Give yourself grace by acknowledging it's okay if you don't believe them right away. Getting rid of shame beliefs can feel like picking ruthless weeds out of a garden. Once you know what truth looks like, do whatever it takes to get yourself to that goal. Compassionately restoring your sexual identity has everything to do with applying the truth of what happened so your worthiness, femininity, and sensuality can heal. Sexual safety first. Our betrayal-induced shame beliefs change how we feel about our bodies. They also influence how we share our bodies with our unfaithful spouses. What's common to all is how we use some type of self-protective strategy to cope with our pain. It's no surprise that every situation is as unique as your fingerprint. Starting a conversation like this is like walking into a swampy marsh. It's dense, foreboding, and messy. It's not just about sex. It's about sexual vulnerability and repairing a breach of trust. Timing and the willingness to reestablish safety are everything. So I'd like to be clear about two things. One, being in a relationship with someone who is actively sexually acting out is one thing. Two, being in a relationship with someone who has worked to establish his sexual sobriety and relational safety by repairing trust is quite another. Remember the concepts atone, attune, and attach? Healthy sexuality requires vulnerability and trust. A powerful word picture for this is seen in the Latin meaning for vagina, a close-fitting sheath for a sword. Seriously, that image is perfect. If we think about our close-fitting sheath, doesn't it make sense why sexual vulnerability requires some say-so or choice in knowing where that sword has been? Of course, sexual safety comes first. What do you need? Is the relationship sexually safe? Is there sexual fidelity? What would it take for you to be sexually attracted again? Where is your safe place to sort out all that you're experiencing sexually? Sharing an impact letter after disclosure is often an important step in receiving validation and empathy for the sexual wounding that occurred. After acknowledging your impact letter, he writes an amends letter to express his genuine regret for how you've been harmed. He walks out his sexual sobriety with truthfulness over time. If the wife's pain over the breaches of trust and sexual wounds is not openly talked about and adequately heard, attempts to move the couple towards intimacy and sexual pleasure may be laden with problems. Healthy sexuality, emotional safety, and sex play will not be authentic if the woman has not received felt validation about the sexual betrayal from her spouse. As with surgery, while there may be stitches on the outside, the betrayed spouse needs to heal from the inside out. Ideas for rebuilding sexual safety. This list creates a framework for dialogue. Sexual repair requires a willingness by both parties to do whatever it takes to recover. Adult conversations that include safety, vulnerability, and trust. Empathy and validation for how the betrayed spouse was impacted by the sexual betrayal. Courtship principles focusing on emotional connection in which partners can talk eye to eye and listen to each other, while providing safe, non-sexual, physical touch, like hand-holding or cuddling, without sexual expectations. Establishing sexual safety. Most therapists and 12-step models encourage an initial 90-day cooling-off period, or abstinence, to stabilize the relationship and help the betrayer abstain from sex to gain perspective about his problematic behaviors. Protected sex and concerns about sexual sobriety need to be addressed. Violations that compromise sexual fidelity can be met with a no. It's purposeful protection and boundaries aimed at repairing trust. A discussion about a plan for sexual re-engagement. Abstinence can be used as a step in the early stages of betrayal trauma to keep the partner safe. In marriages in which sobriety continues to be the goal, a new work towards healthy emotional and sexual connection can begin. Abstinence is not intended to be a permanent landing place. While so little has been written on sexual reintegration, The Couple's Guide to Intimacy by Drs. Bill and Ginger Burkaw has some ideas and may prove to be a helpful resource. Making choices about how and when the partners would like to re-engage with sexual intimacy. Are you more comfortable with the lights on or off? Are you more comfortable with your clothes on or off? You can ask your spouse to patiently walk this out by asking for what you need to re-engage. I often have women read Wendy Maltz's book, The Sexual Healing Journey. She uses a four-part process, stop, calm, affirm, choose, with sexual abuse survivors. The steps can be helpful to betrayed partners too. How long does it take to heal? Bev asked, "So how long does it take before I feel like myself again?" I thought about that for a moment and said, "My personal recovery from betrayal trauma has landed somewhere between a day at a time and the rest of my life. This isn't meant to dash your hopes or tell you something that isn't true. It's a personal journey. The truth is, even today, there are times when I wrestle with my sexual triggers. The self I once was is nowhere to be found. But I've learned to embrace this new version of me. In fact, sometimes when I face a fear and conquer it, I will pat myself on the back and say out loud, 'Go me!' It takes guts to recover, and I've learned to put a voice and words to my sexual triggers and talk about them rather than leaving them in the dark. I've learned to honor all the work I've done to dig out. I love the person I've become. It's a deeper, more compassionate, and heartier version of myself." Part 4. Taking steps towards relational safety. Chapter 15. No is a complete sentence. At some point in our lives, many of us live in an apartment or condominium. Whether we like it or not, we share walls. There's a natural dividing line that keeps my stuff in and your stuff out. Some days we tolerate annoyances like loudspeakers, occasional fights, or the sound of water trickling through pipes. But when there's a big problem, like termites, a dividing line between your drywall and mine becomes crystal clear. We ask three things. 1. Who's the owner? 2. Who's in control? And 3. Who's responsible to fix the problem? I was clueless about a serious termite problem until a painter opened my townhouse wall and unveiled 2x4 studs that looked like Swiss cheese. There was shock on his face, much like there is on a face of a surgeon who opens up a body filled with an incurable disease. He shook his head and murmured, "It's too late, Sherry. There are fresh larvae eating their way through your house and home." Ugh, it was all I could think about. My skin crawled. I didn't sleep. I realized my walls weren't steel. They were porous with hidden crawl spaces under the roof. I couldn't rest knowing what was happening behind the drywall. I called my homeowners association and was stunned when they told me it wasn't their problem. They referred me to a webpage called Tips for Termites. I was now the proud owner of a single unit within a six-pack condo community that was being eaten alive. It was up to me to share the problem and invite 5 other homeowners into a solution that included signing a contract, packing up perishables, leaving for a 3-day weekend, and each paying our portion to tent the complex. So out the door I went with a larva-infested piece of wood and concerns for all of our units. No matter how freaked out I was, I couldn't demand action from others. That was insanely difficult. I wasn't the owner of their units. I couldn't control their choices. I was only responsible for my place. Each person had the freedom to do his or her part or not. I needed to figure out how to take care of my home and guard my investment. If I chose to listen to how I was feeling and do nothing, it guaranteed the problem would only grow. We have to protect not only where we live, but also the bodies we live in. Our hearts matter. Proverbs 4:23 says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it." These hearts of ours are priceless. Like a termite infestation, ongoing sexual deception must be addressed. Recovery isn't optional, and neither was letting my home get eaten alive. I asked my neighbors for what I needed, and I am now living in my home, termite-free. Best-selling authors Dr. Henry Cloud and Dr. John Townsend define boundaries as personal property lines that promote love by protecting individuals. Boundaries define who we are and what we are responsible for. There must be limitations and lines drawn between an unfaithful husband and a betrayed spouse. It's what we ask them for to protect the fidelity of our relationship. Boundaries help us define what we can't control and what choices we need to make. When sexual deception leaks through the walls, setting boundaries invites our spouses to look at what's threatening the relationship and compromising our safety. When sexual deception runs amok. As Roxy grew up, nothing was sacred. Her mom would often rummage through her books, backpack, and notes from school saying, "You'd better not be hiding anything, Roxy. If you are, I'll find it." Roxy's sisters would wear her shoes, makeup, or favorite jeans to school. When Roxy was 13, a neighbor dad, Greg, taught her how to play basketball. Roxy's dad had left when she was 6, so she loved how she and Greg spent hours before dinner laughing and playing ball. One day, Greg asked her to come into the garage to check out a new hoop that he bought. He stood behind Roxy and gently pressed his body against hers as she opened the box. Something felt strange inside. They'd never been that close. When she turned, he tenderly leaned in and kissed her. She'd never experienced anything like that before. It felt very different. Her body trembled in fear, yet awakened at the same time. Greg showered her with playful attention, tight workout clothes, and rides in his convertible. He and his wife asked Roxy to go with them and their 2 sons on camping trips. She felt special to their whole family, like one of their kids. Roxy didn't realize she was being groomed and sexually abused. While her relationship with Greg seemed innocuous to the casual onlooker, his sexual abuse was covert, which made Roxy more confused about what to do. She didn't learn that it was okay to protect herself and wasn't sure where to draw the line. Roxy hadn't been taught that the word no is a complete sentence. "I'm tired of being his porn substitute, Roxy." When Roxy was in college, she met and married Don. They were married 9 years and had 2 children. She knew Don had been looking at pornography for several years, but was shocked when he called her from jail needing money for bail. "Bail?" Roxy exclaimed. "For what?" Don had been arrested for solicitation as a result of offering money to an undercover police officer in exchange for sexual favors. He also had been driving with a blood alcohol level of 0.10, resulting in a DUI. Don had been looking at porn since he was 6. His dad had a hefty stash of porn under the seat of his truck. Don's brothers would strip him naked and for fun throw him into a cold swimming pool. When Don was 7 years old, a 16-year-old neighbor molested him. Painfully, both Roxy and Don grew up with boundary violations. As a result, they weren't able to recognize boundary distortions. Roxy wasn't taught how to protect her property or her body. Neither was Don. He grew up with sexual abuse and neglect. Over time, Don developed a sex addiction filled with reoccurring boundary failures and violations. Together, they were in a mess. How do I unravel this mess? Roxy came into a session panicked. I'm not sure what to do. I got up at 6 this morning to get the kids dressed and their lunches made, then drop them off at school. Since Don was arrested, he's not able to drive. I've been taking him to and from work. He's got an early meeting, and I don't think I can fit all this in. I'm exhausted. As with artwork hanging crooked on the wall, something didn't seem right with this picture. How long have you been Don's valet de chambre? I asked. I'm not sure what you mean. I've been driving him around for 6 weeks now. Wow, Roxy, no wonder you're exhausted, I said. I'm afraid Don doesn't have the problem. I think the problem is yours. What do you mean? Roxy raised her eyebrow. Maybe you heard me wrong. I've been driving him to and from work. I know. That's the problem. A valet de chambre is the French word for noble assistant. Don doesn't have to do anything to work out his driving dilemma. He's got a full-time chauffeur. His problem has become yours. You're frustrated, tired, and stressed to the max. Would you like me to help you reintroduce Don to his problem? Roxy's eyes brightened and the corners of her mouth turned up. What do I do? One simple word can immediately lighten your load. B-U-S. Roxy chuckled. What? I can't do that. Don will go off the rails. He'll be so angry. It was then I presented Roxy with 3 questions. 1, who's the owner of the problem? 2, who's in control? And 3, who's responsible to fix it? Her answer sounded like a melodious movement from Beethoven's 5th Symphony in C minor. In a beautiful aha moment, Roxy said, "My problem has been trying to fix his problem." The purpose of boundaries isn't about trying to punish someone or manage their process of recovery. Boundaries are limits set to help protect us. The offending spouse needs to feel the weight of what they've done and own their problem. As was the case with Roxy, wives play an important role by supporting the natural consequences that may lead a sex addict to hit bottom. When sex addicts realize they may lose family, friends, their reputation, or a job, it can be a much-needed wake-up call. Sheltering them from their consequences doesn't help them heal. In fact, it may actually encourage complacency. Personal pain is often a game-changer. By establishing boundaries, Roxy allowed the natural consequences of Don's actions to fall into his lap rather than hers. Talking with Don about the added stress in her schedule let him know it was more than she could handle. The city bus ran daily. Whether Don chose to ride the bus, walk, or hitch a ride from a colleague, he had time to stop and think about how he got into the situation in the first place. Boundaries, deal or no deal. The non-negotiable boundaries or deal breakers are things you need right now to protect yourself emotionally, physically, relationally, and sexually. Severing all ties with the affair partner is a must. Whether it's a sexual or emotional affair, as long as your husband is seeing another person, he won't be able to look at his issues or restore a relationship with you. Removing pornography from your home, protecting children when needed, and meeting with a counselor or coach who specializes in sexual integrity and sexual addiction issues are critical. Technology makes it easier for sex addicts to hide their history and sex acts. In their book, Always Turned On, Sex Addiction in the Digital Age, Dr. Robert Weiss and Dr. Jennifer Schneider describe how in addition to Facebook and Twitter, social media outlets such as Instagram and Snapchat now allow messages and photos to be sent anonymously without keeping a record of their history. Smartphones are making sexual hookups possible either virtually or in person, anytime, anywhere. Desktops with porn may become obsolete with the rise of virtual reality devices such as VR headsets and genitalia-stimulated wearable technologies called teledildonics that mimic sexual experiences. One reporter describes the virtual experience. Your eyes open to a beautiful woman scantily clad in red lace lingerie. She bats her eyes flirtatiously, then slowly makes her way over to you. But this is not a flesh-and-blood woman. It's a three-dimensional performer in a 360-degree immersive video so convincing you can barely tell the difference. In virtual reality, as nowhere else, donning a pair of clunky goggles allows you to pursue your wildest sexual fantasies. While virtual reality is the new billion-dollar frontier and deception is impossible to eradicate, establishing boundaries for yourself sets the tone for what you will and won't tolerate. A non-negotiable boundary can sound like this. I need to feel safe. I would like pornography filters installed on all devices and computers in our home. I'd like to hold the password. I need our family to be protected. I'm not comfortable having you or our children own a virtual reality VR headset. I need consistency in order to work towards repairing trust. If you relapse, I need to know that you've connected with your sponsor. I'd also like you to let me know about a relapse within 48 hours. Because you have sexually acted out with others, I'm asking for transparency. I would like access to your cell phones and billing statements, email accounts, credit card accounts, and bank statements. Create a similar list of non-negotiable boundaries you need to protect yourself. If your spouse is unwilling to respect those boundaries and continues to relapse, the consequences may include a therapeutic separation, a brief separation for the purpose of recovery, legal separation, or divorce. I initiated two therapeutic separations with Connor as a means of trying to establish safety in sexual boundaries. Eventually, I chose to draw a line in the sand and our marriage ended in divorce. I didn't make my decision flippantly. It was thoughtfully and prayerfully considered. It was probably the hardest thing I had to do. While I still can feel that moment in my heart, it was a necessary ending after several years of trying to make our marriage work. I believe women in similar situations are looking for five things from their spouses to consider rebuilding. 1, remorse and grief over what they've done. 2, empathy over how it impacted their wives. 3, humility in their recovery process. 4, honesty with themselves and others. 5, consistent, reliable behavior over time. When it comes to sexual integrity issues and recovery, I tell women again and again, trust your husband's behavior, not his words. These last five items are some signs that your husband is working on his sobriety and creating a safe environment aimed at rebuilding trust. How to ask for what we need. For many of us, the hardest part of protecting ourselves is asking for what we need. This is especially challenging as we dig